Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by ToughManTry.com, by Everyone.org. That's EveryWN.org. Cool new concept for a half marathon and 5K series. RunCatalina.com. We have the Catalina Eco Marathon coming up on Saturday, November 19th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $75 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. And check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. Our next guest is the author of a new book called Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sports. Mr. Mark Johnson joins us. Mark, how the heck are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
No problem, bud. It's been a long time since we chatted. I think the last time we chatted on the radio was when the Argyle Armada came out.
That's right. That was my last book. The same publisher was Velo Press, and this one takes a little different approach at cycling and a lot of other sports, including running and football and baseball.
So take me back to when you decided that, because we've seen so many books on doping and especially around cycling with David Walsh's book and the book on with Tyler Hamilton, and obviously, you know, Lance has been the subject of so many. You go in a lot of different directions with track and field. With back in the day, it was almost like, hey, guess what? These are these cool new innovations in how to be better in sport. It was almost like a positive to be using other products to be faster in sport. What led you to this book?
Well, I think the focus, as you said, had been on the acts of individual athletes, particularly contemporary athletes like Armstrong or Tyler Hamilton, and they start with the premise that doping is illegal and morally and
reprehensible. Yes.
Right. Wrong.
Cheaters. Yes.
And that is the case today because it's contrary to the rules of most sports. But I was fascinated about how did this happen? Because really for the first roughly 100 years of professional sports, doping was not considered immoral. In fact, it was seen as a sign of your commitment to your craft. And so I wanted to understand how was it that this act had had this complete shift. And as an American, it was particularly interesting because we're a country where we advertise performance-enhancing drugs, whether it be ADHD drugs to improve your mental focus or Viagra to increase your sexual performance on television. And so to me, that was a pretty fascinating contrast. Why do we hold athletes up to a totally different set of standards than ourselves?
What was the first evidence of people using performance-enhancing products for sport?
Really, from professional sports, really started during the Industrial Revolution, and that's when you started to have enough people in big cities like Milan and New York to send people into a velodrome or to a soccer field and pay for tickets to entertain themselves by watching sport. And really, from the very beginning, particularly cyclists and runners, use stimulants. For instance, they had six-day races where guys would race around a velodrome track for 6 days, and they had to use stimulants simply to stay awake. So those drugs weren't so much for performance enhancement, but just for survival. And so I went back and started to look at some of the contemporary press reports from the time, and they did, in fact, say, you know, these guys turn to stimulants because they work. Such great athletes. And also after the 1904 Olympic marathon, which was in St. Louis, Missouri, the guy who won was a British American, and his doctor celebrated the fact that he had used strychnine, because they used small amounts of strychnine sort of as a stimulant. And he said the fact this guy won because he used drugs, and there was no problem with that. It was seen as a sign of his commitment to his sport.
Well, and I remember in the early days of the Tour de France, right, because those guys are climbing ridiculous mountains, and I remember seeing video of people like running into stores to buy alcohol because it's just to deal with the pain. Now, obviously, that wasn't illegal, but that led to pretty much anything goes in this sport just to deal with the pain.
Yeah, and that's France and Belgium were the first two countries to criminalize doping, and they did that in the summer of 1965. And in France, it was because the French government was concerned that the athletes were being exploited by the Tour de France organizers and by their team owners and managers. So that first anti-doping rule wasn't so much a reaction to drugs as something that was inherently bad or evil, but it was a reaction to what they saw as the exploitation of workers. And so the law was focused at the coaches and managers who were administering drugs, and it criminalized the administration of drugs in order to try and protect the athletes from what was seen as an impossible task without drugs. And it always had been impossible. And that's kind of gets to one of the contradictions or difficult issues about endurance sports like cycling, is it attracts us because it is so inhuman, and that's the essence of the spectacle. But in order to do that, athletes have always turned to drugs.
What's always fascinating to me is you look at when people started dying, right? When people were collapsing during climbs and dying in these races. Did that wake people up to, okay, wait a second, this is a problem. We're trying to increase performance so much that we're putting these people at risk because they're doing things that are not proven at all, right? People are just trying things that could work or might not work, and nobody even knows what the side effects are.
It certainly did, although the first supposed example of somebody dying from drugs that really focused attention was at the 1960 Rome Olympics, and there was a 100-kilometer team time trial, and a guy named Knud Edemark Jensen died from heat stroke. But because heat stroke was a kind of boring story,
yeah,
the press turned it into death through amphetamines, even though there was no evidence that he had amphetamines in him. And then in 1963, the Council of Europe, which was kind of a European-wide umbrella organization, held a few conferences looking at the issue of doping in sport and trying to figure out whether it was harmful. And then in 1967, Tour de France, a British rider, Tom Simpson, died, and he definitely had amphetamines in him. So his death was one of the few deaths that we can actually pin on drugs. But once you mix the rumor of drugs with the possibility of death or harm, it's a super fascinating story. And so the media really sort of built a sense of fear and danger around drugs that really was disconnected from the actual risk of doping. Because under a doctor's supervision, doping's actually pretty safe compared to racing your bike down the Alps at 60 miles an hour without a helmet. So the inherent risks of cycling are far greater than the risks of doping. But that's not really the story that got written.
What I was going to say is when I look at doping back in the day, if people were using, especially in cycling, if people were using steroids, obviously you'd be stronger on the flats, but they were a deterrent if you're climbing. And if you're using amphetamines, you'd see those guys taking off from the first pedal stroke on a 130-mile stage, and they get you up, but they also can make you stupid, right? And
sure,
also dehydrate you. With the advent of EPO, all of a sudden you had something that really, there was no downside, correct?
Right, and that's I have a chapter on that because in the early 90s, a lot of stories were being written about a glut of Dutch cyclists who were supposedly dying from EPO overdose, and I looked into it, and there's really no hard evidence that anyone ever was killed by EPO. Nonetheless, the story took root, and sort of EPO became known as this drug of mass destruction. And that's something that I trace throughout the book, is cases where the actual danger of drugs really gets blown out of proportion. And because drugs are seen today as something that's inherently wrong and evil, no one really questioned that. We all just assume, okay, yeah, drugs are really bad, especially in sport, even though we're doping as a culture at large. without those sinister consequences. So that's the EPO story. Yeah. Is something that is really fascinating. It says a lot about both our attitudes towards doping in sport and our attitudes towards doping outside of sport.
One of the things I always wondered is when we talk about the Tour de France, you're talking about racing. You know, it's a 23-day event, and it's 20 days of racing, and you're racing thousands of miles. From talking to Le Mans and guys like that back in the day, they said that, you know, they'd ride a lot of times as a 130-mile stage. They'd sort of stay together for 70, 80 miles. People, you know, they'd stop and pee. The race was really the last 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, it became from the first pedal stroke of the first day. And can the human body do that without performance-enhancing drugs? And then when you think that somebody else is doing it, it leads to, well, if they're doing it, we have to do it. Is the event itself sometimes the problem?
I mean, that's one of the arguments. But then you go, well, you know what? Ben Johnson doped to go 100 meters. So
yeah, good point.
I think you if you made each Tour de France stage 10 kilometers, I think you'd still have people doping.
Interesting point, yeah.
Because, and this is something else I explore in the book, is today the assumption is that doping is corrosive to some sort of state of fair play.
Yeah.
That it's a virus that has infected sport, and if only we could get rid of it, and one of the things we do to get rid of it is try and pull away guys like Lance Armstrong, then sport could fall back under the state of fair play. But when I looked at the historical record, I found, well, the state of fair play in pure sport is an illusion, particularly in pro sports, because doping has always been part of the sport. So what anti-doping is trying to do is not so much return to a pure past, but try and push sport into a state of chemical purity that's never, ever existed. And so that's one of the things that makes the project so incredibly difficult is you're trying to impose a state of moral and chemical purity on sport that's totally alien to it. And it's also contrary to the spirit of elite sport is enlisting technology in order to push the boundaries of human performance. And that could be material science with the design of bike frames. And with swimming, you see the design of the swimsuits. So we're constantly looking, how can we use technology to allow humans to go faster, higher, stronger? And doping has always been part of that. Well, now we're saying not anymore.
Yeah, well, when you think about it, I get an altitude tent, or I live in Boulder, or I go up to Steamboat.
Yeah,
I'm getting an advantage because I'm becoming fitter and stronger at altitude, and that's going to transfer to a sea level event. So you're getting everybody's looking for an advantage. Everybody's looking for that. What's the magic potion that's going to help me? And then you just have to go, well, what's legal and what isn't?
Right, and what's legal and what isn't is constantly
changing.
I mean,
exactly.
until 1984, blood doping and administering your own dope, your own blood, was legal.
Yes.
And then the U.S. Olympic cycling team used it, and again, it was legal,
yep.
Completely legal. And then it sort of blew up into this media scandal, and so then in 1985 it became illegal.
Yes.
And I look into that in the book as well, and it's interesting because even in the medical textbooks, blood doping is covered in a chapter sort of on general medical procedures, like how to deal with road rash, the flu, cold, sickness. And it wasn't until after the 84 Olympics that all of a sudden blood doping gets pushed to a different chapter on doping. So it became illegal. But up until 84, the medical community looked at blood doping sort of as a technical problem. How do you keep the blood at the proper temperature? How do you re-administer the drug without getting infections? And the morality of the issue wasn't even discussed. It was just another way, an alternative to living at sea level. I mean, living at altitude or paying for an oxygen tent. Which today, the other alternative is using EPO, which gives you the same effect as moving to Boulder or sleeping in a tent.
The other thing that always fascinated me, if you think back to the Cold War and how important sport was in terms of the perception of your country, right? We're winning all the Olympic medals. We're a better country. Communism is better than democracy. And you've got a lot of these German athletes, once they were identified as a talent in a sport, they're put through a program. And I'm sure a lot of those athletes had no clue what they're getting. They're just getting what has been designed for them to, you know, to be a better athlete. How did that change everything? From my perspective, it changed everything because, well, to keep up with the East Germans and the Russians, then America had to do it.
Yeah, it did change everything. In fact, the high-performance sports systems that we see today, where you're looking at every potential way to wring out more marginal gains, is a descendant of what was perfected in East Germany. And really, it did affect, well, I mean, what we're seeing today in Russia with debates about should the entire Russian Olympic contingent be thrown out of Rio because Russia had a state-sponsored doping and doping evasion program, is really a continuation of what was formed by the Cold War beginning in really in the 1940s. But in the 60s, the East Germans, and to a lesser extent, the Russians, created a state-sponsored top-down doping program. You know, they were administering 2 million doses of anabolic steroids to their athletes per year. The Russians, the East Germans, really saw an opportunity in the fact that American women were systematically denied the ability to compete at the elite level because partly it was paternalism and partly it was the medical community was afraid that really tough sports would damage women.
Mm-hmm.
So the East Germans said, look, Americans won't even allow their women to compete in a lot of sports. You probably remember when...
Yeah, the longest running event was it even 800 meters for women?
Yeah, and when Catherine Switzer, who raced...
Yeah, Boston. Yeah.
So that was 1967 when she suggested to her track coach that she wants to run marathon. The marathon, he said, no dame can run Boston.
Yeah.
So the East Germans saw this, all right, here's an opportunity, particularly because women have a lower natural testosterone level. So they were administering steroids to women, and the East Germans were just
dominating
the floor.
Yeah, I mean,
in Montreal during our bicentennial year, the East Germans and the Russians took home more than 200 medals, and we took home about 90. So that was something that we had to address, and in fact, I talk about it in the book. In 1983, Ronald Reagan, then President Ronald Reagan, met with the U.S. Olympic Committee executives and said, don't shortchange us. Now, he wasn't explicitly saying dope, but he was sending a pretty clear message that you need to do what it takes to stop this constant embarrassment.
Yes.
And so what we did, where we didn't have a state-sponsored doping program, we took steps to minimize embarrassment. So we allowed the American athletes to be tested at the UCLA drug testing lab before the Olympics so that they would be clean or make sure that they were clean. And then after the Olympics, there was a number of positives, including Americans, and the spreadsheet that had their names mysteriously disappeared. So
yeah.
That drug scandal never
hit. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, the Cold War really ramped up doping, unlike anything we've ever seen before.
So when I look at cycling and I look at track and field, we come under the greatest scrutiny by the media and by everybody else because we've done better testing. And when you look at baseball, football, basketball, baseball's gotten a little better, a lot better. But, you know, the reality is that football, basketball, those guys get tested probably, hardly ever. They sort of know when they're going to get tested. And those aren't drug tests. They're sort of IQ tests. Is there, is it unfair that the endurance sports are sort of put up as, okay, all these guys are dirty because of Lance and Tyler and all the scrutiny that's gone into cycling where a lot of these other sports sort of slide?
Yeah, I mean, at the athletes level for the cyclists and the runners, it is certainly unfair. And why those sports are put up to more scrutiny, well, in cycling, it's one reason is that cyclists don't have a union. So
right,
you know,
good point.
Baseball was unionized in the mid-60s by Marvin Miller, and I actually interviewed him a few years ago before he passed away, and I asked him about drug testing, and he said there's no way that he would allow constant surveillance of his workers/athletes. He would just see it as a fundamental denial of their human rights and
yes.
way too invasive.
Yep.
Whereas cyclists have to report their whereabouts 365 days a year. And if they're not where they say they're going to be when the guy shows up for them to pee, then they're busted.
Yeah, it's so, a test. It's basically a missed test.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So for a unionized group of athletes, they just wouldn't put up with that. And also with baseball and football, there's simply a lot more money. And so
yes.
there are huge economic incentives to keep the doping scandals under the rug, whereas cycling is more of a free-for-all. And likewise with track and field, there isn't that much money in it to justify keeping the doping scandals under the rug.
One of the things that hit me from reading Tyler's book and the different books about all the scandals, one, Michele Ferrari was exceptional at what he was doing. He knew what was going on with drug testing, and you know, those guys didn't go positive while they were with him. But when they left, and Tyler Hamilton goes with different doctors and finds out eventually that the guy's got, 80, 90 patients, and I can't tell one blood bag from another, when I look at the system that Lance's team had, having someone like Michele Ferrari overseeing it all, seem to put them, one, they didn't go positive, and two, their performance was off the charts.
Yeah, and that's sort of where it gets to the reason why we should have some anti-doping laws is because it is unfair, because it's economically unfair, because the guys with the money, like
mm-hmm.
Lance,
yep.
could afford the best doctors and do it, safely, but also do it in a fashion where they can evade the inevitable drug test. Whereas for the up-and-coming amateur who doesn't have 100,000 euros to pay for a doping doctor, it puts them on an unfair playing field. And some of the research has shown that actually there's greater incentive amongst amateurs to dope than actually for pros because of the risk-reward ratio. So there's a lot of reward if you're an up-and-coming pro amateur cyclist trying to break into the pro ranks for distinguishing yourself with the help of doping. And there's relatively little chance of getting tested because you're not a pro, so you're not getting tested all the time. Whereas the research shows that with pros who have already made it, they're being tested a lot more, and so there's higher risk there. And then the damage of getting caught, an eight-year ban potentially, is pretty catastrophic. So there's actually less incentive there for them to dope than for the amateurs. And we also see that with masters racers. Why is a 51-year-old masters cyclist doping so he can win a local criterium?
Well, there's no money, right? He's just doing
right.
it for prestige.
Exactly. It's prestige. It's to distinguish yourself amongst this local cycling tribe, because cycling, triathlon, it's a very tribal activity, and,
mm-hmm.
and we want to be the guy who can ride everybody else off their wheel, and so people turn to doping, particularly when we're advertising testosterone on television. It's pretty easy as an American to go get performance-enhancing drugs.
What surprised you the most from the research you did during this, while you were putting the book together?
I think what surprised me the most is coming to a fuller understanding that doping is not just the act of degenerate individuals, which is really the easy, consumable package story that we get.
Mm-hmm.
If only we could get rid of these creeps like Lance Armstrong.
Dirtbags.
Doping would go away. But when you look at the history of the Cold War, you realize that the forces either encouraging or overlooking, so in the Soviet Union and East Germany, it was specifically encouraging and facilitating doping, whereas in the United States, it was by overlooking doping and putting together systems so that our athletes could avoid testing positive. These nationalistic forces and geopolitical forces are so much larger than anti-doping that you look at it and you go, anti-doping doesn't have a chance against Cold War forces, nationalistic forces. And then also the economics. Really, the Olympics realized its full economic potential in 1984 with the L.A. Olympics. And why was that? Well, it's a fascinating story because in 1978, the citizens of Los Angeles saw what an economic debacle Montreal was. So Montreal Olympics were sold to the citizens of Quebec. It's going to cost them $300 million. It ended up costing $3
billion. What?
Oh, my God. It ended up costing $3 billion. So L.A. did not want to get screwed. And so the citizens of Los Angeles passed a referendum in 78, making it illegal to spend taxpayer dollars on the L.A. Olympics.
Wow.
So that meant that Los Angeles had to create an independent corporation because you couldn't have politicians running it. So Peter Ubroth, yep, who was a business genius who had already created a very successful travel business, was put in charge, and not being able to use taxpayer dollars, he went to corporate America.
He sold every sponsor there was.
He did, and he did a fabulous job of it. The Olympics ended up being in the black $230 million because one of the things he did was that he minimized the expense of facilities. So he housed athletes at UCLA, USC, UC Santa Barbara. The IOC hated it, because the IOC is used to calling the shots.
Yep.
But they had no options because L.A. was the only city that was left, because the other one that was in the running was Tehran, but there was a little revolution going on.
Yeah.
So that was going to happen. So Ubroth really had all the leverage, and so he ran a very successful Games. And after the L.A. Games, Juan Antonio Samaranch, who was the then president of the IOC, it really opened his eyes to the economic goldmine that was in the Olympics. And the IOC really hadn't realized that potential yet, because they were still stuck to this notion of the amateur games, that the Olympics should not be sullied by commerce, which really goes back to the foundation of the Olympics, which was formed by the first Games were in 1896. A French aristocrat, Pierre de Coubertin, created the Olympics really as a way to celebrate and protect aristocracy. It was the original Olympics were for gentlemen, and that is
rich people
who don't work. People who don't work and inherit their money and power, and even training was frowned upon. It was seen as ungentlemanly. So, anyways, the LA Olympics really completely changed the IOC's understanding of the economic potential. And so it's easy for us today to say, well, if only we could get the money out of the Olympics, then the pressure to dope wouldn't be there. Well, as Americans, we really need to hold up the mirror and say, look, we are the ones who unlocked the economic potential in the Olympic Games that persist today, because we did such a good job of managing the 84 Olympics and also demanding that no taxpayer dollars be spent on the Olympics.
You mentioned Juan Antonio Samaranch, and I remember having Mark Ziegler from the Union Tribune on this show, and we were talking about doping. And he was saying that Juan Antonio Samaranch was one of the problems, because he did not want drug testing. He did not want any athletes to be go positive and have anything go public, because he felt that hurt the Olympic cause, right? And so, and what is your feeling on Samaranch?
So he was really pragmatic, and after at the 84 Olympics, he saw that the anti-doping, then growing clamor for more anti-doping would really damage the Olympic project, because the Olympics, even though it might sort of live in this fantasy land of amateurism, it still has to exist in a world of commerce, and somebody needs to get paid to build those stadiums and feed all those athletes. So there's this tension between, okay, we need to make it an economic success, otherwise it can't happen. And doping scandals
don't help.
They don't help, because the reason that that multinational corporations attach their names to the Olympics is because it has this mystique. And scandals, corporations don't want to be involved with a scandal. So there's the, really what he was saying is these scandals are bad for business and bad for the Olympics. So is he a hypocrite or is he a
businessman?
No.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that's really what this book looks at, is that the challenge of anti-doping is so much larger than we might initially see. And Samaranch, he created a lot of sort of a big media furor after the Festina scandal in 1998, when a bunch of riders were thrown out of the Tour de France, guys were being thrown in jail. And he said, he told a Spanish journalist that anti-doping should focus on drugs that do harm.
Yes.
And if it's just increasing performance but not harming you, then we really shouldn't worry about it. And what he said makes a lot of practical sense, but he was pretty tone deaf because of what was happening at that very time in France. And so it really blew up into, okay, this guy just wants everybody to be doped to the gills, and he's an immoral creep. So that sort of lended to the sense that he was very pro-doping. I think he was more just
pro-business.
Let's put on some successful Olympics. So, and that demands compromises.
Yeah.
It always has.
So when you watch endurance on television, when you watch a great performance, are you more skeptical now than you were, say, 10 years ago? Like, rather than just getting carried away with, oh, my God, that was amazing, do you start thinking, gosh, this guy didn't ride that well last year. All of a sudden, he's, you know, winning these stages. I'm wondering what's going on.
I wouldn't say I'm more skeptical. I think, actually, the process of writing this book made me more sympathetic to what these guys have to go through, both the financial and social and nationalistic pressure, particularly the athletes that are coming from more dictatorial countries where they might not have that much agency and the ability to say whether or not they're allowed to dope. But as far as cycling goes, where you have pro cyclists, I mean, they are riding the Tour de France this month, not because they're doping, but because they are the best cyclists in the world. Sure, they might be doping, but I don't really think it takes away from the unbelievable nature of their achievement. And I almost look at it, understanding that doping has always been part of cycling from day one. I think I'm actually more likely to cut them some slack. And I almost look at cycling as I focus in on the aesthetic beauty of it. It's almost like watching the Rolling Stones. Do I judge Keith Richards because he takes a lot of drugs? No, they're still great. It's still a great performance. And I almost feel that way with watching the Tour de France or any other bike race.
It's interesting because one of the things that always got me was, like you mentioned, so you've got the U.S. Postal Service team where the top guys are, they're blood doping, they're doing EPO, they know what to take, when to take, they sort of have an inside and know when they possibly are going to be tested. And then you know there's some other teams that just don't have the funding. And those guys who could have been great cyclists, or even someone like an Andy Hampston who left at the top of his game as a cyclist because he could see what was coming and he didn't want to go down that path. Does that type of stuff concern you, that, you know, there somebody's getting an advantage here that the person with less financial wherewithal isn't going to get?
Yeah, and I think it really... And that's where I think it still makes sense not to just have an open class, high octane,
right?
No rules.
Funny car.
Yeah, it's because, you know, the 18-year-old kid who just discovers this phenomenal talent and is all of a sudden killing it on the weekend rides and says, "Wow, I might be able to make it at the pro level." They don't want to dope. Even the established pros, they don't want to dope. It's expensive. If they're doing it without a doctor's supervision, it's potentially dangerous.
Yeah.
And so it just adds to the complexity of their jobs. So, yeah, it's really, I look at the younger guys and go, yeah, it's not as ideally. It's a choice that they wouldn't have to make, and that's where what anti-doping is trying to do is trying to change a culture, and a culture that has been influenced not so much just by individual athletes' decisions, but massive nationalistic and economic forces that are way, way harder to change than the decision of a single athlete who's making decisions, do I take EPO or do I not? And it's almost like it's a missionary type of endeavor where we're trying to impose a new state of moral and chemical cleanliness on natives who have always turned to chemicals. And so it's a very difficult project.
Did it surprise you when all this came out recently about the Kenyan runners? That, you know, because I always thought the purity of, here, these guys are running the school barefoot. They're up at, you know, they're in Rift Valley up at 10,000 feet. Just these were natural athletes who just went out and kicked everybody's ass when it came to long distance running. And then to find out there was systematic doping with those guys, that was a shocker to me.
I don't think it would ever surprise me that in an Olympic level sport would be turning to doping, because again, that's the nature of elite sport, is to enlist available technology to increase human performance. And particularly in the 21st century, we all know the technology that's available, and doctors know it's available, and breakthroughs in sports medicine is quickly known around the world. So, no, I mean, it certainly didn't surprise me. I mean, the question for us as a society is, do we pass judgment? How much judgment do we pass on these guys for doing what everybody else has been doing? I'm not justifying it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that I'm already getting pushback in this book, because people say, well, just because doping's always been part of the sport, by talking about it and pointing out that it's long been normal, you're going to give people rationalization for doping. And that's what I'm not saying it should be legalized, because the rules are today that you shouldn't dope. But this is a relatively new set of rules, and sports are still struggling to adopt them.
So when people read the book, again, the book is Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sports. What do you want the reader to come away with from that?
I think more than anything is an understanding that doping is a collective endeavor, and we're complicit in that endeavor, particularly as Americans. I mean, Americans didn't have an anti-doping agency until 2000.
Wow.
We are really, really laissez-faire when it comes to doping, whereas, you know, France criminalized it in 1965. We didn't do anything for 30 years compared to France. So our attitude has been much more, well, if you're not hurting anybody else, then you can do whatever you want with your body. But that's really the takeaway, is it's a collective endeavor, not just an act of individually degenerate athletes. And once we understand that we're trying to change cultures, then we come to a better understanding of, okay, what steps can we take to try and change these cultures?
So when you mention the word doping, the first name that's going to come to anybody's mind, besides, you know, Ben Johnson back in the day, in this country, is going to be Lance Armstrong. Do you think Lance has been too much of the lightning rod for people's disgust at doping?
Well, I think he certainly feels that way, and he certainly feels like he was unfairly singled out by cycling community and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. I don't think that Tygart had something out personally for Armstrong. I think that Tygart is just an anti-doping agent who takes his job very seriously, and unlike the Russian Anti-Doping Agency, was immune to government pressures to overlook some doping, whereas the Russian Anti-Doping Agency, as we know now, no, was working with the government not to rat out dopers, but to cover them up.
Right.
So what USADA did, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, in taking away Armstrong's seven titles, was pretty unprecedented and pretty bold, and it sent a message that maybe an anti-doping agency can be independent. And I think we're seeing the same thing happening now, too, with how is the World Anti-Doping Agency going to treat Russia? I mean, if they end up throwing out the entire, all the Russian athletes,
yes,
that will be simply unprecedented, and it would suggest that maybe anti-doping is acknowledging that doping is a collective endeavor.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, Mark, first of all, congratulations on the book. I can't even imagine the amount of research that went into it. How long were you working on this?
I became fascinated with the topic because in 2011, I spent a year traveling with the Garmin
yes.
team, which is Jonathan Vaughters. He used to race with Armstrong, and he quit cycling because he was fed up with the doping, and he created this team with this crazy idea of racing in the Tour de France level without doping. So I spent a year with them, and that really got me interested at the hands-on level with efforts to try and race without
yeah.
doping. And then from there, I just started to look into more of, well, what about the history of doping? Why did it become so immoral when it's always been part of the sport? So really, since 2011, then I spent 2 years researching it in depth.
As a top bike racer yourself, Cat 1 racer, have there been times when you're racing, and a lot of times you're racing the same guys week after week, all of a sudden somebody's at a level they were never at before? Have you had suspicions about other age group guys or other Cat 1 racers that, I wonder what they're doing?
Well, I'm Cat 2, but I certainly know what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
There's always those suspicions. But I don't know. It really hasn't bothered me. I always look at if I'm getting shelled by somebody else. My inclination isn't to blame it on them for
right.
doping. It's blaming it on myself because I didn't put enough hours in or do enough intervals.
Gotcha.
So at the personal level, no, it doesn't really bother me. I mean, to me, I go, well, if you got a dope to...
If you got a dope to beat me, then you're wasting
yeah.
your time.
you got a dope to be better at your hobby, that's your problem, not mine.
Yeah,
I'm glad it's your money you're wasting, not my money.
If you've got to be doping to win a water bottle, have fun with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Love it. Again, the book is called Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sports, from Velo Press. I'm assuming, Mark, you can get it pretty much anywhere online.
Yep, you get it all the usual bookstores, and we've also got it in Kindle, Nook, all the ebook formats. So,
love it. Again, we are brought to you by ToughManTry.com, Everyone.org, RunCatalina.com, our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $75 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. Subscribe to our Babbittville newsletter. And as always, endurance lives here.